This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Welcome to Turkey Trend, part of Ahval podcast series. My name is Nevana Mahmoud. President Joe Biden has become the first American president to declare a formal recognition of the Armenian genocide. To discuss that today, it's a pleasure to have Aiken Erdemir, Senior Director of the Turkey Program in the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. Thank you, Aiken, and welcome to, and it's a pleasure to have you in this podcast.
Thank you, Nirvana. It's really great to be here, and thank you for hosting me.
Thank you. Right. A few minutes just before we joined this podcast, Erdogan have spoken about the Armenian genocide. And he said it will have a between arrow destructive effect. I want first to start with a question. Why the word genocide is irking Erdogan a lot? Coming from a man who happily used the term genocide for other atrocities around the globe, like Palestine, Srebrenica, Circassian genocide. Over the years, he used the term so much. Why it's okay to use the term in other atrocity, but not this one?
You know, I'm known for being very critical of Erdogan, but here is one case where I will not totally blame him, because he's not an outlier in Turkish politics, meaning this is really not a peculiar position imposed by Erdogan. This is more a reflection of mainstream Turkish politics, covering almost the entire spectrum. And just to clarify this and to give a concrete sense of where Turkish political parties stand, only Turkey's second largest opposition party, the Pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, has a public call for the recognition of genocide, for amends making, and also for coming to terms with the past to prevent new hate crimes and new crimes against humanity from happening. So Erdogan here, I think, is a symptom of the Turkish political space rather than being the driver of this. In many other fields, I always argue that Erdogan is the driving force, you know, from Islamism to economic mismanagement to corruption. Erdogan is really the cause, the root cause. But when it comes to Turkey's inability to come to terms with the Armenian issue, I think Erdogan is more a symptom than a driver.
I completely agree with you. I remember intense debate with my grandmother about the Turkish stance. And I also remember visiting Isfahan and seeing a huge map on the wall of an Armenian cathedral of what once was an Armenian population in Anatolia and other Ottoman provinces and how they completely vanished. So I perfectly understand where this is coming from. But let me ask you, does some historian, especially Western historian, had an impact on the Turkish stance, like Bernard Lewis, for example, who a lot I saw on Twitter are quoting his famous video when he said, no, it wasn't a genocide. How does this impact of politicizing history affected the Turkish stance?
Now, there we also have to bring in a later assessment by Professor Bernard Lewis, who said over the years and decades, you know, language changes. And the word genocide, the terminology, which used to have a more narrow legalistic sense, has come to have a much broader sense and has been used in different contexts. So he actually, toward the end of his career, changed his opinion about this and expressed that he could understand how people could use it in that different sense. And I think this is an important issue, because ultimately I think most of the debate within Turkey revolves around the legal or international legal implications of the term. So this becomes purely a formal legal definitional exercise, whether what took place in 1915 could be classified as genocide in that narrow legalistic sense. Right. But I think what many Turks are missing is, for example, President Biden's statement is not a legal text.
No.
Or last year, what both chambers of the U.S. Congress passed as resolutions, they were not necessarily international law texts. So what Bernard Lewis says, the broader sense of the term genocide is the one that's being used here. And ultimately, my own take on the issue is always that I'm less concerned about what the average Turkish citizen refers to what happened in 1915 and its aftermath. I'm more concerned about the absolute lack of empathy and understanding the average Turkish citizen seems to have concerning the enormous pain individuals and communities have suffered. Mm-hmm. And this is not to discredit many Turkish claims that many Turks suffered, many Kurds suffered, many Muslims suffered.
Correct.
Sure, you know, that was the First World War and many individuals suffered. But I think one should really avoid whataboutism, meaning the fact that other communities have suffered as well should not necessarily make one callous, not just in sentiment, but also in rhetoric about other people's pain. And this is, I think, to me, the most concerning part of what has happened. Meaning, when you take a look at, for example, Turkish American diaspora activism over the last four decades, it literally revolves around pushing back in very callous forms on April 24th.
Right.
So I always say this comes down to a zero-sum game. It's like, absolutely, you know, your pain comes to mean the denial of my pain. No, actually, in these, you know, the First World War, Second World War, we see that pain and suffering and crimes against humanity is not a zero-sum game, meaning on all sides of these conflicts, there are individuals who have committed crimes against humanity. And Biden's statement, I think, walked a very fine line in referring to the Ottoman authorities.
Absolutely.
And so this is, I would argue, a question of whether today Turkish citizens would like to own up to the crimes of the Committee of Union and Progress, you know, the Troika, the namely the three leaders who have caused enormous suffering, not only to Armenians, but to Turks themselves. You know, hundreds of thousands of Turks perished and Kurds perished at the hands of ill-advised policies, you know, adventurism led by the Committee of Union and Progress in criminal collaboration with German imperial ambitions. So again, I would urge people to take a different look at the past, not from a state-centric point of view, but from a humanitarian perspective, you know, recognizing the common humanity in all of us.
Perfectly understood where you're coming from. Is that you mentioned Biden's statement and it is well-crafted. Do you think President Biden avoided the Greek genocide, Assyrian, other communities just to make it well-balanced and not to overwhelm the Turk with his stance, or just because he was focused on the Armenian because he promised the Armenian that declaration?
Now, first of all, the occasion for the April 24th statement was Metz Yegern, as Biden pointed out specifically to what the Armenians called this great pain and suffering.
Right.
And but at the same time, yes, the statement itself was really very carefully crafted. Like, let me highlight a few items. First of all, it did not refer to Turks. It referred to Ottoman authorities.
Correct.
I think that was important. Mm-hmm. It also consciously used Constantinople, the name of the city when the 1915 mass arrests took place in Istanbul back then. And I think that was also a conscious effort to, you know, differentiate modern day Istanbul and its residents from Constantinople and the policies of the Committee of Union and Progress, you know, the political party behind all these mass killings. Yes. And then there is also this, I think, very important line where Biden says, you know, this is not to cast blame. And so he, I think, signals very strongly that this is rather a call for understanding and, you know, reconciliation. So whether that ended up, you know, being the result is a different question, because so far a lot of the reaction from Turkey does not necessarily revolve around amends making, reconciliation, and peace building. But I still would like to highlight that in most media accounts, there is an acute absence of the changing attitudes within Turkey.
Yes, I read the piece for you. You mentioned that. So please elaborate more.
Yes. So I think, first of all, you know, I mentioned the fact that Turkey's second largest opposition party, the HDP, the pro-Kurdish HDP, has a very different stance. But that's not where all things end. You know, beyond the HDP, I know numerous Turkish citizens at home, also many hyphenated Turks in the diaspora and hyphenated Kurds in the diaspora, whether they use the term genocide or not, have a very critical take on the crimes against humanity perpetrated by the Committee of Union and Progress and their military and civilian accomplices. And yes, there is a generational aspect to it, meaning probably a younger generation of Turks and Kurds are thinking quite differently compared to their parents and grandparents. But it's important to recognize this as well, meaning Turkey is not a monolith. Turkish citizens are not a monolith, and Turkish diaspora is not a monolith. And allow me to share with you a very moving anecdote I have, an experience I lived through in Diyarbakir.
Yes, and I've been there.
During one of the Easter liturgies held at the Armenian Apostolic Surp Giragos Church, mm-hmm. you know, which was restored after almost a century of being in ruins, mm-hmm. I met with a Kurdish journalist. And this journalist was the grandson of a Kurdish notable, a religious man, who killed seven Armenians, including some of his own household staff.
Wow.
And so this Kurdish man told me that he was raised all his life by his parents and relatives, telling him that his grandfather went to paradise because upon killing the seventh Armenian, his hands turned green, which was a divine sign that he was promised paradise. Wow. And I was, as you can imagine, I was listening to this like with really great shock. That's and it. Then he turned me and he said, but if you ask me, he went straight to hell. Now, this is, I think, a very telling anecdote because it shows us, first of all, that generation-wise, attitudes are changing. And even when such change in attitudes entail a critical reflection on not only the nation state one belongs to, but also toward one's immediate family members and relatives, people can still move forward. People can still think critically and people can still change their minds. So I know there has been a lot of, let's say, pessimism lately, a lot of negative discourse that came out of Biden's statement. But I would like to, even amid all of this, you know, let's say pessimistic mood, I would like to inject a dose of optimism.
Absolutely.
Because against all odds, there are really brave individuals who would like to change the terms of the debate, who would like to prioritize, you know, empathy, amends making, reconciliation, and peace building. And, you know, in my humble capacity as a, you know, former Turkish lawmaker, I had a draft bill, which of course did not pass. But, you know, even the motion to present this draft bill, I thought was the message in itself. And I proposed that all former Ottoman citizens who lost their citizenship, as well as their offspring, their descendants, who have lost their citizenship rights because of the enormous pain of the First World War and its aftermath, should be restored their citizenship rights, should be restituted with their citizenship rights. So that, for example, is one way in which Turkey can make amends, not just to compensate others, but I presented this as a win-win move because I think you would be in a great position to appreciate this.
Yes.
There are numerous descendants of Ottoman citizens around the world. Mm-hmm. And they could be actually a great resource for Turkey. I always call them, they could either become adversaries of Turkey, or they can also become Turkey's honorary consuls, Turkey's bridge builders around the world. But that requires, first and foremost, a step to be taken by Turkey and Turkish citizens, so that, you know, it takes two for the bridge to be built, but it always takes someone to take the first step. And I think historically and politically, that responsibility belongs to Turkish citizens.
Perfect. Let me move back to Erdogan and Biden. They agreed to meet next June, I think. But now, with all the high rhetoric inside Turkey, do you see any future of understanding between both of them, that they can have a mutual business as usual? I agree that a lot of commentators have mentioned that pragmatism will prevail. But after mentioning this is destructive and all these big words, do you really think Erdogan will calm down and go back to pragmatism? And what will happen if they didn't agree in the June meeting?
So a couple of different takes on that. First of all, Erdogan needs this vocal criticism at this point to save face at home. So this is, again, typical Erdogan theatrics that we are used to. So I'm not really reading too much into that. Second, I'm also one of the analysts who use that Turkey and the United States will go back to business as usual. But I think there the key term is business as usual. That is, U.S.-Turkish relations are at an all-time low. Mm-hmm. And business as usual means simply, and even in the best case scenario, continuing to negotiate for a transactional relationship.
Right.
I think at this point, as long as Erdogan is at the helm, a trust-based relationship that is typical of two NATO allies will never, ever be achieved between Erdogan and any of his Western counterparts. So this is not just about Biden. This is not just about the United States. But as long as Erdogan is in power, you know, buying the S-400 air defense system from Russia, you know, asking Russia to build Turkey's first ever nuclear reactor, building TurkStream pipeline, helping Russia bypass Ukraine with its natural gas exports. You know, no NATO ally will ever trust Turkey. No NATO ally will see Erdogan as a dependable, trustable ally. So this is also the case with Biden. So at best, you know, when the two leaders meet in June, I think we can expect what they already stated in the U.S. readout of their phone call last week, an effective management of these disagreements. So I think at this point, this bilateral relationship is not necessarily about really constructive steps forward, but it's mostly about avoiding further headaches, avoiding further conflicts. And to be frank, I think this has nothing to do with the Armenian genocide statement from Biden. I think it is a logical result, outcome of the numerous anti-American, anti-NATO, anti-Western steps Erdogan has taken and the explosive rhetoric he has used. So if Erdogan is really disturbed about the state of affairs, bilateral affairs at this point, I think he should simply look at the mirror, and he has no one else but himself to blame for it.
Right. Today as well, there was a news and a headline that they dismissed 532 army cadres, accusing them of being Gulenist. This is 5 years after the coup in 2016. And I want to ask you, obviously, I'm sure Erdogan will ask about Fethullah Gulen in his meeting with Biden and want to hand him. But to what extent this president is becoming paranoid? Does he want to purge the Gulenists from the army, or purge Turkey from the current army cadre and accusing them of being Gulenists? Because I found that a little bit unsettling. How do you see it?
Now, let me again try to give a nuanced response here. You know, on the one hand, on the one hand, yes, there has been a significant Gulenist present, not only in the Turkish military, but also in the entire Turkish law enforcement system, including the police and the judiciary. Mm-hmm. How do we know it? Because it was no one but Erdogan who made sure all these key posts were filled by Gulenist loyalists when Fethullah Gulen and Recep Tayyip Erdogan were allies. And they were the ones who actually systematically purged all the secular types from all these institutions. So that's the first answer. But at the same time, there is the flip side of the coin, and that is when we take a look at various so-called Gulen trials, we see that some of the leading pro-secular names in Turkish media, academia, have been targeted by Erdogan for being Gulenists. And of course, these are farcical show trials. And I can give you a couple of examples. For example, today, Osman Kavala, who is Turkey's highest profile philanthropist in jail, has been accused of being a member of the Gulenist terrorist network by Erdogan. Wow. And anyone who knows Turkish history knows that Osman Kavala was one of the first liberal intellectuals who publicly spoke out against the show trials that Erdogan and Gulen initiated against the seculars in the military. So he was really a brave public intellectual. Then, you know, Kadri Gürsel, one of Turkey's leading secular intellectuals, was accused in a similar way. And then Ahmet Şık, an investigative journalist who was one of the first to call out the Erdogan-Gulen infiltration of Turkey's law enforcement, and spent time in jail, targeted by the Gulen-Erdogan alliance, was then investigated and jailed again for being a Gulenist. Now, the moral of the story is this. Today, Erdogan uses show trials and criminalizes his opposition and even his secular opposition for being Gulenists. This shows that anyone with any critical approach to Turkey should take every single Gulen trial, Gulenist trial, you know, with a grain of sand, because Erdogan now has a really consistent track record of targeting secularists, including some of the leading opponents of the Gulen movement, as Gulenists. So I think this shows how dark the Turkish legal system what a dark period the Turkish legal system is going through, and there is no more any real rule of law or due process to speak about.
Finally, do you see Biden handing over Fethullah Gulen just to try to build a bridge with Turkey again?
Now, for that question, let's go back to when Biden used to be the vice president. And during one of his encounters with Erdogan, and when Erdogan asked him to, again, meddle with the U.S. legal system, Biden has a very clear response to him and tries to teach Erdogan about separation of powers and checks and balances. and tells him that if, as the executive branch, he tries to, or President Obama tried to, you know, intervene in judicial affairs, that they would be impeached. Right. Now, whether Erdogan got the message, whether Erdogan learned his lesson, we can't say, because we know that Erdogan has absolutely no notion of separation of powers or checks and balances. He has amassed executive, legislative, and judicial powers. So he reshuffles judges and prosecutors when he doesn't like their moves, their legal opinions. So maybe today Erdogan is so disillusioned because of this amassment of power that he can't really imagine a U.S. president not dictating over U.S. courts. But anyone who knows the U.S. legal system knows that the executive branch, let's say, has extremely limited capacity over the legislative branch. You know, I will not argue that it has none. Of course, in all systems, sure, there is some, you know, feedback mechanism going both ways. But ultimately, my guess is President Biden will know his position as the executive. And if Erdogan asks him, he will tell him that this is a matter of the independent judiciary. And he might again remind him, if as the executive branch, he tries to intervene in judicial affairs, he will be impeached. So he will not touch that even with a long yardstick.
Aiken, it's always a pleasure to hear your perspective. And I wanted to venture into the Halk Bank, which the trial will start in May, but I would love to postpone it to another podcast and look forward to have you again, if you don't mind.
It will be my pleasure. Thank you for having
me. Thank you so much, Aiken. And thank you for being with me in Turkey Trend. And thank you very much for listening. This is Nirvana Mahmoud. See you in the next podcast.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.